nap in a day. So if you ever try to cram an entire, remember, like elementary school age summer camp into one day, that's what we're going to do next Saturday. This is going to be good. So we will probably all come back dirty with holes in our knees and lots of scrapes to tell mom about, even though we didn't change our clothes. That has nothing to do with the sermon. But it's going to be fun. It's really going to be fun. It's going to be neat. Funny that you should mention research. Nobody's ever mentioned research in prayer before. And that I got a text I want to share. I'm going to rat Mike Hendren out. So Mike and I are texting yesterday, talking. This is one line in a series of texts from Mike back to me. He says, because we're talking a little bit, and he says, at 8:28 a.m. yesterday, rarely do scholars give simple, satisfying answers. Rarely do scholars give simple, satisfying answers. And I didn't respond to that because he was right. See, because scholars know when not to step in that bear trap. And there are lots of things that are inadequate or flawed about the academic endeavor. There's lots of things, lots of flaws that scholars have. And we do rarely give simple, satisfying answers. Instead, but there's one of the strengths of research, and one of the strengths of being a scholar is being trained to do that kind of research. And it always complicates the simple answer that you want to give. Because it'd be like asking Rick, "Hey, Rick, so what's an implied note?" You hear that laugh? Hear that laugh? Come on, Rick, what's an implied note?
Oh, you mean a ghost note?
Yeah, like a ghost note. What is it? You see that grin on his face? See?
It's like when you finger the note, but you don't actually play it.
Mm-hmm. You got it? And why would you finger and not actually play it? Is that a satisfying answer? No, it's not a satisfying answer. And the long answer is that in the complex conditioning of how we encounter sound in the Western musical tradition, there are certain notes that go together, and if you play all of them but one, you hear that note anyway, and you long for that note, and it's important, and it has a role in there, and you are actually hearing a note that's not really there, and you can you go to the note, but you don't play the note, but the note's still there. It's like, you know, do re mi fa sol la ti. You just had to do it, didn't you? See? Oh, I love pinafores. So scholars are trained to look at the background, because a lot of times the answer is a little bit more complex than it looks on the surface. But that background, that research underneath, even though it may not be a simple, satisfying answer, it gives insight. We look into the background for some understanding. And a lot of times that changes our outlook on something, gives us a kind of a depth of encounter of it. And that's I think that's important. So, for example, it's baseball season, right? Baseball! Did I get that right? Did I get it right? Is it starting baseball season now? It's the beginning. Yeah, spring training. Spring training, it's like, bounce, would you? Sorry, wrong kind of spring training. Right? So, and what happens at every baseball game? How does it start? National anthem. And how did that? Anybody know how that tradition of national anthem? Let me share my research with you. Actually, there's a little bit of a dispute whether it started in the late 1800s or early 1900s, but the most well-known and most attributed moment was the first game of the 1918 World Series. And it was the seventh inning stretch. And it was the tradition, it was sort of the habit during baseball games because it was in the middle of World War I. It was the habit of the owners of the teams to have bands there that played patriotic songs during the different sort, you know, beginnings and ends and transitions. They'd play patriotic songs to kind of rouse the crowd up. And they broke into the Star-Spangled Banner. And the Star-Spangled Banner was just a patriotic song at that point. And yet, some of the team members, inspired by that song, turned, the Red Sox, turned and just faced the flagpole, like stunned. And the whole crowd stood to its feet and turned and faced the flagpole and then cheered afterward. And the owner of the Red Sox was kind of moved by it, and he told the band to do that at every seventh inning stretch for the rest of the World Series. And I got it picked up as a habit in the baseball world. So they began doing that at the first opening of the season, and during the World Series. And then came World War II. And it was just such a crisis for the nation that during the baseball games they would try to reinforce that, and they played the national anthem every time in order to begin it. And that began a tradition in baseball to play the national anthem every time the game started, and that spread to other athletic events. So that now it's a tradition at all the athletic events, which is kind of funny because it started when the national anthem wasn't the national anthem. Did you know that? Anybody know when the national anthem became our national anthem? What's that? Nope, but close. Just before, 1931. Anybody know what the national anthem was before that? You know why you don't know? There was no national anthem before that. In fact, Ripley's Believe It or Not in 1929 published a little blurb that said, "Believe it or not, America has no national anthem." And that kind of sparked Congress to adopt the Star-Spangled Banner as the national anthem in 1931. Now, Woodrow Wilson, just before this World Series in 1916, had declared the Star-Spangled Banner to be the anthem to be played at official military opening ceremonies. He was following the lead of the Secretary of the Navy, who had said to do so in 1889. Isn't that interesting? You know what's even more interesting? Anybody know what the tune? Have you noticed how hard it is to sing the national anthem? Everybody try that, right? It's an octave and a fifth. Okay? It's like... You know where that tune comes from, anybody? That's America, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, is God Save the Queen. Or God Save the King. Actually, originally, God Save the King. 1775. What? But the tune, that's the poem. We'll get to that in a second. The tune. Yes! Round of applause for Mike Hendren. Woo! The tune for the Star-Spangled Banner was originally the theme song from an amateur musicians society in 1805. But that song didn't go so well. And Francis Scott Key, on the boat, by the way, was not a prisoner of the British. Did you know that? He was not a prisoner of the British. He was a lawyer. And he had been commissioned by President Madison, I believe, to negotiate the release of a captured American. And so he went with another guy on an American sloop out to the British flagship. Now, there was a fleet of over 50 British ships in the harbor there, getting ready to bombard Fort McHenry in Baltimore. And he went out there and negotiated the release, had dinner with the British commander, had a nice lawyerly talk. Isn't it ironic that the the national anthem was written by a lawyer. Anyway, so had a nice leisurely talk, negotiated the release of this prisoner, and then the British commander said, because you've been on board and you have seen all of our preparations for the coming battle, we can't release you. You're going to go back and tell everyone. So in order to prevent espionage, please go back to your American vessel and stay there until we're done attacking you. In probably a very British way. And then we'll have tea afterward. Hopefully in Baltimore, which is off. Thank you. Okay? Good. And then the bombardment began. And it went all night. And by the way, how many stanzas are there to the Star Spangled Banner? Anybody know?
Four,
officially. Five after 1861. Yeah! Because Oliver Wendell Holmes added a fifth stanza to it as a protest to the Civil War. Does anybody know the line or the lines for the other stanzas other than the first one? Shall I read them to you? There is a point to this. Don't worry about it. We'll get there. I actually brought an iPad. That's because the printer's in my daughter's room, and she was sleeping. So we know the first one. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming. And the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave? On the shore dimly seen through the mists of the deep, where the foe's haughty host in dread silent reposes, what is that which the breeze o'er the towering steep, as it fitfully blows, half conceals, half discloses? Now it catches the gleam of the morning's first beam, in full glory reflected, now shines in the stream. 'Tis the star-spangled banner, O long may it wave, o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. And where is that band who so vauntingly swore that the havoc of war and the battle's confusion, a home and a country, should leave us no more? Their blood has washed out their foul footsteps' pollution. No refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave, and the star-spangled banner in triumph doth wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. Oh, thus be it ever when free men shall stand between their loved home and the war's desolation. Blessed with victory and peace, may the heaven-rescued land praise the power that hath made and preserved us a nation. Then conquer we must, when our cause it is just, and this be our motto, in God is our trust, and the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave. And Holmes's addition, Oliver Wendell Holmes, when our land is illumined with liberty's smile, if a foe from within strike a blow at her glory, down, down with the traitor that dares to defile the flag of her stars and the page of her story. By the millions unchanged who our birthright have gained, we will keep her bright blazon forever unstained, and the star-spangled banner in triumph shall wave, while the land of the free is the home of the brave. Interesting. And something happens in us when we read that. It's sad, isn't it? It kind of makes you sad and happy and hopeful and weird all at once, right? You don't know whether to cry, laugh, stand, or sit down. Yeah, or be brave. You don't know whether to go boldly out into the future, sort of like William Shatner, or whether to reflect solemnly upon the past. That's what anthems do. See, if you think about that moment when Scott Key was, by the way, the little anecdote is that flag didn't fly all night. It didn't fly all night. There was an extremely heavy rain falling that night, and they took the battle flag down, or the main flag down, and they raised a battle flag, a smaller flag, because the main flag was 30 feet by 20 some odd, no, 30 feet by 42 feet, and took 11 men to raise, made out of wool. And if you fly that in a heavy rain, the wool gets so heavy that it breaks the flagpole. So they took down the big one and put up a small one. Then in the morning, when the rain had stopped, they took down the small one and put up the big one. So it didn't fly all night like the song says. But if you think about that moment, when you know that your people are going to be attacked and you can't do a thing about it. Now, remember, this is the War of 1812. How old is the United States at this point? 40 years old. 40 years old. Okay? For those of us who can remember, that's the same as 1976 to now. Okay? Everybody grunt again, right? That's the same as 1976, the bicentennial. How many of you here remember the bicentennial? Okay? That would be the same as till now. Good? Actually, it's less than 40 years because it was 1814. So it's like 37 years. Okay? And Britain is the global superpower at that time. You're talking the British Empire in the early 1800s. This is Britannia or the waves when the sun never sets on the British Empire. And you've got your fledgling little nation going, we have a flag too. We just made it. Do you like the colors? We're not sure if we're going to keep it this way. Stars used to be kind of in a circle. We changed it last year. And there's the might of the British Navy. 50-plus ships around this little fort. And here you are on your 50-foot American schooner rocking next to a British tri-decker. Typically either a 72-gunner or a 110-gunner. Okay? Right? Just towering over you. And they just bombard all night long. And you're thinking, are we going down in flames now? Are we even going to make it out of this war? By the way, Francis Scott Key was an adamant and vocal opponent of the War of 1812. He said it was a dreadful mistake based on ignorance. He said, don't do this war. And then he stuck there watching the bombardment happen and the anxiety through the night. And then finally the dawn comes up and there's the flag. And he has this overwhelming moment of going, us, our people, this thing that's bigger, solidarity, loyalty, patriotism, and he starts talking in we talk. How wonderful it is to be us. Note, if this were a rock ballad or a modern song, this would be all about how scared I was on my sloop. How scared I was on my sloop and how relieved I am that my experience has changed and, oh, weren't they bad to me? And I can't wait to get off this sloop and go see my friends again. That's not what that is, though. It's all about that flag, our people, this greater thing. Being free and being brave. That's the whole point of an anthem. An anthem points to the larger, not the individual. And it does so in light of crisis and in light of the experience of strain, oppression, trouble, and the kind of tempering and hardening of identity that does. And it yields a sense of unity, and you don't know whether to stand up, to laugh, to sit down, to cry. All you know is I am in the presence of something far larger than I, and it has to do with who we are. If you have a Bible, turn to Exodus chapter 14. When you think of the civil rights struggle in the 60s, what song comes to mind? Oh, the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Yeah, that's one of those. That's one of them. No. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Do you hear that connection? We shall overcome. Despite what has happened, we shall overcome. We're going to endure this. We, not I. The anthem of the civil rights movement was not, I shall overcome. It's, we shall overcome. We shall endure. Now, for those of you who haven't been with us, we just started a new series, God's Vinyl. The songs in the scriptures. So we're looking at God's song collection in the scriptures. And I thought it would be fitting today if we looked at really the first major song recorded in the narrative of God's people. And this is the first national anthem of the people of Israel. And it comes out of a very similar situation as Francis Scott Key's pen. The people of Israel had been oppressed. They'd been enslaved for 400 plus, who knows, it's kind of a fuzzy. They kind of put the number 400 on it, although the time frame is fuzzy, how long the people of Israel were in Egypt under bondage. But they were an oppressed people, and God brings them out with an incredible deliverance. Charlton Heston and the Ten Plagues and the Ten Commandments, rather, with all the plagues of Egypt. And God brings them out with a mighty hand. They're incredibly relieved to get out of Egypt as a fledgling people kind of wandering out going, "Whoo, that was a long time. Who are we again? I know we did the Passover thing, but I don't really know who you are." You know? The problem is that the Egyptians are still there. Israelites, they don't have any experience with a government. They don't have an army. They don't have any sharp pointed objects. They don't even have like Twinkies to throw behind them at people. And the Egyptians are the global dominating power of the Middle East at that time. They are like the British Empire or the U.S. today. You just don't mess with them. They dominate the world. In fact, this appears to be at just after the reign of the Hyksos dynasty. And the Hyksos are the ones who brought the wheel to Egypt. They're the ones with chariots and nobody else has them. Okay? Imagine you've been a slave all your life. You don't know how to use a pointy object. You don't know how to defend yourself. And coming after you are people with horses. Actually, they use wild or trained asses, mules. The Egyptian chariots were mule chariots. And they can do 25 miles an hour. And yeah, and you can stand there. And they have shielding on their chariots. And they can run you down with a lance. And they've got archers in their chariots. One guy drives, the other one's the archer. Okay? Really a scary critter. We don't realize how scary the chariots were. But, and they're right behind, all those powers are still there. They lost their firstborn, that's true. But that might just make them mad. And everybody's going on foot, and they hit the Red Sea, and they know that Pharaoh and the armies are coming to get them. They have no plan of defense. And the Lord calls Moses to raise his hands. He puts a cloud and separates the people of Israel from the Egyptians, and then separates the ocean. And what most of us don't pay attention to is that they crossed at night. Can you imagine how frightening that would be? It's windy, it's night. You have never been in this place before in your life. You don't know the people around you. There is an army behind you, and you know how deadly they are because they've killed lots of you Jews before anyway. They were your masters. You have been beaten down by them. And now it's nighttime. And there's water on both sides of you. And you're walking on the seabed. and you don't even know how far it is to the other side or what's on the other side. All you can do is march. We pick up the story in Exodus 14. Look at, let's see, verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land so that the waters were divided. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land. Anybody ever been on the ocean at night, by the way? Yeah. Scary. Dark, especially if it's windy. It's crazy, much less walking through it with the sea pushed back on both sides. The sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen went in after them into the midst of the sea. Can you imagine the sound of that? At the morning watch, the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. So this is by the dawn's early light. He caused their chariot wheels to swerve and he made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters may come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots, and over their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them, not even one of them remained. Can you imagine the noise? The chaos, the dying horses. This is not a pretty sight by the dawn's early light. And as dawn starts to break, the ocean rushes back in, and it's absolute chaos and destruction. And at that moment, the people of Israel realize we're really, truly free as they see the bodies start washing up on the shore. And they realize their oppressors are gone, dead, taken care of. And for the first time, Israel is truly an independent nation with nothing hanging over them and no one chasing them. It says, "But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea with the waters like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord." By the way, that's the appropriate response. Yes. "And they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses." And then what happens is we get a song. Now this song, like the Oliver Wendell Holmes version of the Star Spangled Banner, shows lots of telltales of having had a long history of development. It's the only version, apparently, that the compiler of the book of Genesis has at his disposal. And it bears telltales of a later time, but it's the earliest version of the anthem that comes from this moment. And no doubt that anthem was sung and resung and resung, and that's how it reaches its final form. Its first form is probably the one that Miriam sang, which is a lot shorter. But this is how the anthem ended up when it was finally approved. "Then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord and said, 'I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he's hurled into the sea.' The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him. My Father's God, and I will extol him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army he's cast into the sea. Notice that that's the refrain. And the choicest of his officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep covers them. They went down into the depths like a stone. Your right hand, O Lord, is majestic in power. Your right hand, O Lord, shatters the enemy. And in the greatness of your excellence, you overthrow those who rise up against you. You send forth your burning anger, and it consumes them as chaff. At the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The flowing waters stood up like a heap. The deeps were congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My desires shall be gratified against them. I will draw out my sword and my hand will destroy them. You blew with your wind, the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who is like you among the gods, O Lord? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises, working wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. In your loving kindness, you have led your people whom you have redeemed. In your strength, you have guided them to your holy habitation. The peoples have heard. They tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over. O Lord, until your people pass over, whom you have purchased. You will then bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, your place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign forever and ever, for the horses of Pharaoh with his chariots and his horsemen went into the sea, and the Lord brought back the waters of the sea on them. But the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea. Now, there's a lot of parts to that anthem that we're not going to unpack. Okay? Particularly the parts about Philistia has heard, and Edom has heard, and Moab has heard, which would be very strange to happen on the morning that it happens. And they trembled, and, oh Lord, you'll bring us to your holy mountain, your sanctuary, which is probably going to be on that holy mountain, and that mountain's going to be holy about 700 years after. So, that's the Oliver Wendell Holmes verse. But what I do want to bring out of this is this. You don't hear anything about I. There's not a speck of I in there. There's no speck in the I. This is all we and you. And this is a song about that which is greater than Israel and that which makes Israel great. It's its anthem song, and it's all about the Lord. But it's all about the Lord in a sense of relief. And it sings about something bigger, loyalty and majesty and solidarity and a future that comes out of God's action in the past. That's what anthems do. It says, we have been through a crisis. This is what we came from. This is where we're going. And they stand up and they do this. That's what anthems do. They make you stand up and go, I'm a part of this. It's we who are going somewhere and who have really been through it. What I want to encourage each of us today with is that there is an appropriate place for standing up and being proud of your heritage as a Christian. I'm reminded of the little shop in Kapa'a on Kauai. There's a little shop there. And in great big words, the title of the shop is, Yes, I Skate. And I don't skate it. I don't like skate culture. But if you can stand up and go, yeah, I skate, or like yesterday afternoon, I'm sitting in the backyard trying to prepare, and I hear this hip-hop thing from the neighbor next door, and the refrain is, I don't care, I don't care, I don't care. And I'm going, I do, you know? But if you can stand up for your hip-hop and say, I don't care, I'm hip-hop, or, yeah, I skate. I just let my actions talk for me as a Christian. Then let your action be this. There is a place to say, our God is among us. He has done great things for us, not just for me. Our God has saved us. Our God has walked with us, not just this year. Our God is not a principle of philosophy that we're arguing whether or not it's valid with the philosophers of our day. We stand on a tradition of 3,000 years. We say, that's my God. He has done great things. Over and over and over again. I testify that God is in this world. I don't need proof of God's existence. He's active. He's been active. He's taken us through things. He has saved us. And we shall overcome. And we will not be silenced. And this is not an empty pop ballad about my experience alone. We are part of a great legacy. This anthem of ours, this, we as Christians, this anthem is the beginning of our heritage too. It's the first time the people of God were a nation and they stood up and went, look what God has done. What I want to tell you today is that our background matters. The backstory of our salvation matters. Who we are today stands. It's like we're just the front, we're the top layer of a glacier. A little dusting of snow on a glacier. Majestic and mighty and powerful. God at work in the world through the ages. And that background makes a difference and lets us understand more what we're on about and who we are. And to proclaim that boldly and clearly in a world that desperately needs God. And is foolish enough to reject their very source of life. So for our conclusion before the benediction, would you please stand?
Praise God from whom all blessings flow. Praise Him, all creatures here below. Praise Him above, ye heavenly hosts. Praise Father, Son, and Holy.